Hi, this is Gareth Stack of the Vidcast and podcast Technolytics. The following audio file is an interview between myself and Bernie Goldbach of the organisation Digital Rights Ireland, recorded on Friday the 27th of January 2006.
Well, the case on Tuesday was about major record labels, Sony and Warner, and the third one. They were asking the court to force Aircom, BT, and Irish Broadband to reveal the names of subscribers, their phone numbers and mailing addresses, of people who had shared 501 or more tracks in an upload status. So they had identified through a company called Media Century IP addresses of people in Ireland who had files on shared folders in their homes and had those files available for upload. And the court was asked to grant an order to the three ISPs to reveal data on those people who were availing tracks for sharing. That's the ruling. And the ruling was, okay, you have 7 to 30 days to pony up the names.
Cool. So you guys at Digital Rights Ireland, you informed the ISPs of a case in Holland.
Yes.
Where the European law was cited, and it was stated by the court that under the European Data Protection Act that the ISPs actually couldn't provide this information. It was in violation of European law to give this information to Media Century as a US company.
Right.
And so the court seemed to react to that. I believe that the lawyers for the record companies stated that litigation is currently being conducted in many countries and the courts there apply the data protection legislation as they find it. Can you tell me what that means?
Right. Well, you see, the Justice Peter Kelly was told that that has happened in Holland. And in fact, he was told that in Holland they did not approve of the method being used by Media Century to gather the information. So he took that on board, so yeah, okay, I'm aware of that. And I think he also acknowledged the fact that he was aware that the European Union was about to turn the screws on the way that the data is gathered and then held in another country and then not being afforded any kind of protection under European statutes. So all the Digital Rights Ireland people did was they told all the solicitors involved in the case that this is an issue, how the data was gathered was an issue, and that indeed the way the data was gathered is deemed illegal under at least one European constituency's court system. The second thing they informed them of is that there are important, and as DRI would put it, paramount issues concerning anonymity and privacy that are basically compromised by a court revealing names of people who they're not sure are actually doing anything wrong. So the court took that on board, but then waved it off, saying, "Well, look, the property issues here, or the violation of the law that's happened is certainly tantamount, more important than any rights that people might have for privacy or anonymity or data protection." So the court has subordinated those other important rights to the issue at hand at the moment, and that's the ruling.
So essentially, the court is saying that this case, property rights, is more important than individual right to privacy.
Right, and more than that, I think if the transcript is any guide, it would seem that the justice involved also thinks that the people's behavior is more like an industry of criminality than a common habit of gathering tracks and sharing them. So, you know, it's like in a sense there's an air of a hanging court that permeates through a lot of these proceedings. And so in this particular case, it's you know, it was more of a procedure. Yeah, you came to tell me about something that's happened. I believe the methodology and the forensics you're showing me, and I'm going to issue this order that those people have to have to have their identities revealed. And that's what happened. So none of these other issues, privacy, anonymity, you know, the rights of a customer to save tracks into from one form of media to another, none of that stuff was material or relevant on the day. Just the movement or the motion made by the recording industry. That's the only thing that counted.
So it's quite interesting that the judge in the States, as you stated, he determined this thieving and almost industrial in scale. Is he aware that there's a profit on the basis of fostering in this particular case, in any case, that nobody downloading or uploading is making any money from it? And how does that impact on the idea of being an industrial scale of criminality?
I think the numbers equal industry, and I think there's an assumption made that nobody would, in their right mind, would actually share something and give it away. So on the matter of industry, it's like saying, okay, some industrial strength Hoover was required to get that many tracks, some industrial strength service is required to share that many tracks, and some industrial strength criminality or mindset has to be in order to keep doing this. So he wouldn't have thought that within a space of a few months somebody could possibly accumulate 500 CD tracks and then share them out to hundreds of people in an evening. So it's just that idea, I think, that crossed his mind, is the sheer number of tracks. I mean, I know people that don't have 500 tracks of music in their home. So if the justice was of that same mindset, it wouldn't be unusual to think, my God, 500 tracks, much less 500 CDs. And yet you're probably going to college with people that can say, yeah, I easily acquired or used or ripped 500 CDs so far in my life. So we're dealing with a generational perspective here. Yours is different than what might be sitting on the bench right now.
In essence, it's almost a confusion between, on the one hand, between what's commodity software is being confused with an industrial purpose, and on the other hand, what's in fact, as you say, to my generation, seems like a very reasonable and normal amount of music, not necessarily to foster, but to possess, as being some kind of grand quantity in the perception of the court.
Yeah, that's how I'd read it as well. It's when you're dealing with issues of law, there's a lot of little surprises that are gonna come up against common sense, and I 500 tracks is just freaking so minor. I mean, I'm shifting 200 gigs of stuff back and forth in personal storage networks, so that's nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
It wouldn't be worth the court's time. What might be worth the industry's time is not to sue its customers, you know, and not to take on an adversarial role the way people want to consume music digitally. I mean, as this court was being, as the date was being firmed up, there's music industry data which says that it's the trend line's upwards. People want to purchase, want to consume, want to download music digitally. And that's maybe the direction the industry ought to be going in. It's exerting its energies that way. Sure, you know, I'm not saying it's something's legal or illegal. I'm not going to get into that argument. Just that there's so many better ways to spend your time, not going after your own people, you know, just your own customers. So, anyway.
It does seem kind of throat-cutting. Do you think that this sort of judgment, due to the fact that the European law seems to have been ignored in this case, would be challengeable in a higher court or, again, an Irish court?
I don't know. You see, I'm not a solicitor, so I don't know. I don't know. I know that the behavior pattern, the consumer behavior pattern in most cases is when the authorities come knocking, you want to negotiate them leaving. So most people just pay up a portion of the amount that's being given them as a demand payment. They do it in increments, you know, a handy monthly debit plan, or they waive it off and pay 2/3 of it and everybody goes away. But I mean, I know teenagers whose parents know they're doing a lot of file sharing, and the kids have no idea what's on the computer, from the tracks they downloaded to the spyware that they've embedded in their system to the viruses they've caught. They have no idea. So maybe it is a good wake-up call for some people to be a little bit more responsible on the, you know, when they're connected on always on environment. But you know, it's just that's a second argument, secondary argument to the real one, which is like, you know, do we want to let this very suspect data hoovering occur without being challenged. That's the issue, I think, on the first regard. The guards don't get away with doing interviews as they wish and places that they call. The venues are controlled, the methods are controlled, the videotapes are done. And this is similar to it. You know, how do you gather your evidence, and how do you safeguard it, and how do you protect the rights of people when you may overstep the boundaries of legitimacy? So that's what.
And of course, it's an interesting point that, as you pointed out, the assumption that, as you pointed out in your podcast, rather, Underwear in Ireland, the assumption that IP addresses tied identity is completely flawed.
Yeah, I'd say it is. I mean, it's, you see, somebody can sit outside, not in my premises now, but where I used to live in Kilkenny, they could sit outside the front door with their white van, with their laptop, and use my IP to do file sharing. You can do that in three spaces in Clonmel on Main Street. So I could stand outside of the takeaway and do it on Queen Street. I could do it also down in... on O'Connell Street. Guys, students at Tipperary Institute, actually, they have nodes that are open, and I can see the nodes with my laptop. So I could do them in. If I set up a Nutella node in my car and walked away and let it work all day, they'd suddenly have a, you know, 50, and then 150, then 501 tracks being shared. I don't like those services. I don't use that. But, I mean, that's the situation. You could expose yourself because you have an open node. So
indeed, and could that potential? I mean, that work as a two-sided coin. Could this be used as a defense by those who've been sued?
Maybe, but I think the target that they have, that the people they've gone after, I think those people aren't smart enough to know that. So, and they're not, like I said, they're. I'm not defending their behavior. I'm just saying I am challenging the method used by the state, endorsed by the state, or used by the industry.
Indeed, and you suggested on your podcast that those who perhaps feared that they might be rightly or wrongly accused of such file sharing would use techniques such as spoofing track names.
Yeah.
And how do you feel that the use of peer-to-peer proxies and so on to guard one's privacy while using this kind of service?
Well, we're the Chinese students that come through Tipperary Institute learn how to do that before they return to home country.
So I think, really?
Yeah, I think it's important that it's important for any democracy to be able to distribute pamphlets in an unsigned fashion, to write a letter to the editor anonymously, and to deal in a realm where you're blanketed for as a whistleblower. So you can't disrupt that very effective model of softly speaking, quietly forming a judgment without identifying yourself to the people in charge. You can't damage that model. It's an essential element of a democratic state. And that's the standard, I think, that a lot of people are rallying around in the Digital Rights Ireland group. That you don't want to mess with anonymity. You don't want to mess with privacy. Stuff starts to happen to the state when you give too many imperial powers to the government or to the industry. And that, you know, you got to draw a line. And, you know, like I said, I'm not defending criminal behavior or petty thievery by some idiot that, you know, has bought as many tracks as they're sharing somebody. So I'm not defending that. I'm just saying that there are issues here about how you do your business. And your business model can't get in the face of important democratic business models of operation. So that's to me, that's the issue. That's a big issue. And the judge ought to take that on board and not flex from it. I mean, they toss out capital cases in Ireland, the DPP does, because of tainted evidence or methodology that doesn't conform to best practice. And this is one of them. This is another one, too. We need to kind of step it down and say, wait, do we move forward based on, one, the way you've gathered the data, and, two, how you're saying that these people actually did it? I mean, How much can you trust? Judge Curtin, it's another case with porn. He's got a defense mounted on the back that, you know, he didn't let stuff come in his computer. Some spyware did. And that's kind of the argument you're suggesting is indirectly as well. It's like people could say, that wasn't me. That's not me on that IP. It's my IP, but my IP is open. And, you know, it's not on my hard drive. Look. So, I mean, people could actually use that. Here, take my computer. Find it on that computer if you can. It's not on that computer. I'm telling you. It's somebody else who's outside in the street. Or I share my IP with 10 people in my estate. And it's the Portuguese guys that were using it. I know that. I can see them in their back garden. I mean, these are makey-uppy arguments. But that's actually the way it could go. And you could actually mount a defense that way. I don't think the people being accused will mount that defense. But you could.
Possible reason why they mightn't spend such a defense is indeed the cost of taking such a defense to court. And do you think that's in the minds of the record labels and the recording industry in taking these cases?
Yeah, because they're basing, this is a consumer behavior pattern. It's how they've enjoyed the success when mounting these kind of scare campaigns in the U.S. They've gotten payment in most cases. So it's an easy mark. You know, it's an easy, proven way of doing it. And everybody doesn't like the sight of a sheriff knocking on the door, the person that they go bowling with or go golfing with or take their kids to school with, demanding a payment for something they did or didn't do. They want them off the estate. They want to make the payment, make it go away. And that's what's going to happen.
Speaking of the United States, it's interesting to note that while there have been, to date, 7,000 lawsuits, file sharing continues to rise in the United States.
Right.
As does legal purchase online of music too.
Right, right. And most people who are going away from file sharing are going away because it's corrupting their computers, not because they couldn't get what they wanted. Shoot, too many viruses, weird spyware, don't like the pop-ups that are happening. So they just back away from it because it's an irritation. Like I said, stupid people are doing, I think. I don't know, I shouldn't say that. But the only three people I know that have more than 100 tracks are very dumb. And I tell them, look, this is the reason why your system's running slow, and this is the reason why you got that spyware. And they just don't see it. They just click on everything that says, offers them a choice to go yes. It's just stupid. But anyway.
Okay, getting back to the case for a second, there was a statement by, I think it was Irish Broadband, or the solicitors for Irish Broadband, or perhaps it was a general statement from all the ISPs, that they don't and can't monitor the use of their connections. Now, obviously that's not true to an extent. While they can't monitor, you know, open connections, they can certainly monitor what's uploaded and downloaded. In fact, they have to under European law. So does this translate into the fact that they don't want to be seen to restrict what users access? They don't want to be called by the court to prevent access to peer-to-peer, for example?
Ooh, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know yet. I was actually looking over my shoulder here when I got a little text message that flew in there. So give me this first part of the question again. Who and the restriction of peer-to-peer? Do you mean the Irish broadband restriction peer-to-peer or any ISP peer-to-peer restriction? I didn't catch the first part of that.
What I'm wondering is that perhaps the reason that the ISPs claimed that they don't and can't monitor connection use is that they don't want to, for a variety of reasons, they don't want to be called to, in fact, restrict ports, for example, or just restrict the use of certain kinds of software on their connections beyond the restriction that exists in their EULA agreements, actually restricted in hardware.
I actually think there's another twist to that. If the ISP says that this kind of behavior is not only not condoned, but that they're going to prohibit and restrict it and block it, then in a sense, they might be held as an accessory because they say they block it and they don't. You see what I mean? It's like they're in reverse being held as a publisher because they said they're monitoring it. Now, I'm not sure they can be held to task, but you know, it is really a pain in the systems administrator's daytime routine to keep restricting things. I mean, it's easier just to focus on how do we keep everything wide open and flowing, as opposed to, you know, who's trying to ping on that little port and what malicious behaviors over here. I mean, this used to run a checkpoint systems firewall. Man, just the mad stuff you had to do to keep it patched, to keep the OS stable, to report on exceptional flags, to respond to someone who's all of a sudden, whose attachments flooded into a certain rule. It's hard. And it's a resource, and you know, it's just another thing you got to do that day. But, you know, there's reasons why you want to do it. But to be restricting the access of paying customers, most of the time that's not the way you do things. I mean, it's like the same argument. Build a nice motorway and what? Put a toll booth on it? I mean, most people want to build something to make it move, not constrain it.
Exactly, yeah. So getting back to, as you said kind of repeatedly and emphatically, I don't condone copyright infringement or file sharing of copyrighted files. So how do you, what would your stance be on copyright law reform? And for example, the Electronic Frontier Foundation in the United States is a strong advocate of changes in the law to essentially make various forms of charges and taxation cover the costs of lost or incurred supposedly by peer-to-peer in order that the public not become essentially a huge body of lawbreakers. How do you feel about that sort of issue?
Well, I don't think there should be this perpetual copyright. So that's on one hand. I don't know about the blank media charges. If everyone had a blank media charge, I guess I could live with that. But I think that there are plenty of other models where I think the industry is trying to feed itself, not feed musicians and not feed the artists, the creatives. So I think, you know, we have to kind of unpack and try to figure out who's lobbying for all this. I mean, how many writers are and how many musicians are? And that's actually the labels. It's the Motion Picture Association of America. Those are the guys pushing for it. And, you know, they're trying to maintain the second and third layer of their administration with these fees and with the protection of their IP. Then to some extent, the IP they're trying to protect through copyright is part of the shares, that the value of the company. And then when Snow White goes out of copyright, shit, that's a lot of money that Disney suddenly loses in terms of what their asset or what the company is worth. And I think that's the real issue, is that some of the stuff, some of the high-end gold-plated copyrighted assets, when they do roll over to the public domain, will cost companies in terms of depreciated assets. They don't want to see that happen. So I don't like the idea of perpetual copyright or rolling copyright. And in terms of blank media charges, if that may work, I think I'd rather pay an artist, have an artist have to be paid the second, third, and fourth time a CD sold, as opposed to charging everybody for a blank CD. I think that's just a whole lot more fair, is, you know.
Sure, sure. Well, in terms of other issues that Digital Rights Ireland are involved in, do you want to give us a rundown of what people should be watching out for, what's important, and what rights are being threatened and taken away?
Well, the ID card issue is coming up as an important one. It's like how you, for the common travel area in England and Ireland, you know, what should be the stance on an ID card? Data protection, two ways in terms of getting information, free flowing of information, freedom of information from the government, as well as protecting your information once it's compiled into a database and stored and filtered and sifted. So those are some big ones that are they're European as much as they are Irish, and there's probably 8 or 9 more. But the ones that are on the radar scope in the short term are data protection, anonymity, privacy, and copyright of digital assets. That's basically the ones on the short list, but. The European list is probably 40 or 50 items. It's a small group. Digital Rights Ireland is a small group, and you know, we're not necessarily cherry-picking issues, just trying to focus on ones that won't cause us to get too scattered.
And just kind of winding up, I think we spoke probably before we started recording on something people might not be aware of, as you mentioned, iPods and the transfer of music to iPods.
Yeah.
Do you want to give us a little rundown on that and why people should potentially be scared?
Well, I don't know if I'd be scared about it, because I don't think anyone's going to stop doing what they're doing, and because some leading lights in Ireland would be quite upset if the practice of moving music they purchased to an iPod, an iRiver, an MP3 player was constrained by the government. But the rule is, the law is, in Ireland you cannot legally buy a CD, a cassette, or a record, and then move it to another storage device. So you can't, like I do, I buy CDs And if I use them in my car, they get scratched. So I make a copy of them. Now, that's the first act of illegality I've crossed over. I can't even back up my own stuff. I back up everything. And then I couldn't certainly move it over from the CD to an iPod without violating current Irish law. So that's a fact. And I think it needs to get changed that through an education process so people know that this is something that's not smart, that affects them personally. And
so, of course, in the case of transferring to your iPod, you're technically infringing twice because you're making one copy on your PC and one on your digital
device. That's correct. Yeah.
So I could be wrong, but is the liability for that, would that equate to a similar liability to the infringements in the cases that we've been talking about? As in, were we talking possibly up to €1,900 per track that you have on your iPod in theory?
Yeah, Yeah, it is. Someone did the numbers on that and figured out, like, for like an 60 gig iPod, how much of a violation it'd be. I don't actually know that for a fact, but yeah, there's statutory protection under copyright for copyright infringement. There's a table of values there for the value of the penalty based on the amount of time you've done it or the kind of work you've done it to. So there is actually, it's not a toothless law. You could find yourself in violation and having to pay more than a traffic fine. So I should actually look that up and find out, you know, just exactly how much have I violated with I got, I don't know how many tracks, more than 200 on my iPod. Most of those are pod safe, so I'm all right. But you know,
And as you mentioned, I mean, this is obviously something that's not going to come to court in the near future because it wouldn't be in the label's interest to do so. But I think maybe you'll agree that it's an example of it's a right that's being upheld, not because it's a right, but because it's in the interest of those who are persecuting other rights, or at least threatening them to do so.
Right. Yeah. So I'd say that, you know, the Digital Rights Ireland guys will blog about that, because I mean it's something I'll take to heart now, and I'll actually run it by the guys over coffee and say let's try to put some real numbers to this. Damien Mully, he's got a weblog at mully.net. He's talked about it online as well. He's active in the area of Ireland offline and Irish broadband interests. So I'd say that he's probably got something on his blog that actually does some numbers for you. But I will write about it on the heels of this at irish.typepad.com, because I am interested in making sure people know the raw numbers that they could get held for, get done for. Even though, as Pat Kenny, the state broadcaster, would say, ah, sure, no one's going to do that. You know, they'd have to get me too. Say, right, Pat, they would. So let's make it a talking point and explain to people that it's their rights, so it's their lifestyle that's being criminalized. Let's explain that. So expect to see that in the future. We'll document.
Great stuff. We'll definitely look forward. Listen, thanks a million for speaking to us, Bernie. And we'll go and stick this up on with today's show.
Okay. Thanks a bunch. Talk to you. Bye-bye.
See ya.